Still got it?
Well, the thing that's working with it, so things are going better.
Yeah. Today, the first day, I'm feeling like I got about 3/4 of my energy back. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I think with the flu, I think, I felt the faint one, too. I felt like I was a kid all over again.
Let's see.
Well, I didn't get the shot, so.
Okay, so. Do you know where Drummond is?
It's just kind of through our office, so I'm not the kind.
Okay, the, it's a 30-mile west of where Hoya comes.
Okay.
It varies on. So if you're going west, you go further.
I'd like to go ahead and open the meeting if I would, if that's okay with you all. Betsy, are you on the phone? She's in another meeting right now, so she's gonna be listening in.
I am, yes, thank you, Linda.
Hi, Betsy, I'm Linda Polly, and most of you know me from last time. We'll do introductions again because we know that there are too many people in the room. And I just wanted to let you know that several members aren't able to be here. Betsy Schultz is not here, but she's listening into the meeting on the telephone. And who are the other two? Rob Castleberry. Yeah, the Helmers I don't see here, so they will give another few minutes. And also Jeff Schwartz from Johnson Crushers is not gonna be here today either. He's in Michigan. And he's not able to call in because he's on. So thanks everyone for coming again. And before we do the introductions, I just wanna say a couple of things before I turn it over to the group, and that is reviewing the objectives for the next two workshops. So as we discussed last time, our mission that I've been given by the Springfield City Council is to work with you to come up with some high-level vision statements for the College View study area, which is the area that's shown in green on the maps over there. And so we are hopeful that by the end of this process, and we have today and another meeting, and if necessary, we'll add another one, that we're going to come up with those statements that would then be delivered to the council by me at a work session on March 23rd. And the vision and goal statements need to address environmental, social, economic, land use compatibility, transportation, and infrastructure concerns that have been raised, and to try to find positive ways to move forward with that. We're also going to be talking about commerce and industry types that would be appropriate in this area, and land uses that are consistent with the vision and goals that we discussed. So to add to that conversation, I've given you some more materials today that are in front of you on the table. And I'll go through what those are to make sure everybody has. So you should have a copy of the agenda. You also should have a copy of the minutes from the last session, which just are hot off the press. So I understand we haven't had time to look at those, but you'll have time to look at them after this meeting and to let us know if there's anything that, oh, I didn't really say that, or you didn't get that right. Please let us know and consider this to be a draft. We'll fix it next time. You also have in front of you a packet that looks like this. It has a paper clip on it, and it has the agenda on the first page. On the second page, it has this thing called industry intelligence. This is a report that the city commissioned with a consultant, and I wanted you to have a copy of that because we asked the consultant to look at our target list of target industries, which is also in your packet. It looks like this. And this came out of our 2008-2009 commercial industrial building land study. So what we did is we asked our consultant to pick, I think we had her look at 8 of the target industries that Springfield had identified, and asked her to do some more detailed assessment of what the site needs for those industries are. So I wanted you to have a copy of that because a lot of what we talked about last week also was about quality of life and what types of employment is attractive to our area and our region because of our quality of life. So you can see how that relates to how industry looks at sites, because I think you'll see a lot of overlap there. I've also included, this was a statement that was submitted by John Helm. Elmer on February 6th. It's Vision for CBD in Mount Vista. A lot of people signed on to that. That's included here. I also gave you on the very last page, it doesn't have a heading on it. It says executive summary at the top of the sheet. This is from a report that Chris Orkinger gave me that was a report about the Confluence area. And it included this 5 goals toward a positive future. So I'm including that as an example of what goal statements look like. And we'll talk more about that as we get into our discussion of visions and goals. So anyway, that's what's there. I also brought pretty much the same maps that I had last week. On the maps on the wall, the smaller map in the middle and the map on the right is a better map that shows where the waterways are. So you'll want to take a look at that probably on your way out or sometime today as well. Because one of the creeks wasn't showing up very well on our original map. So I asked Mike Engelman and our GIS staff to remap that to make sure that we have that located correctly. Okay, so that's it. So I'd like to just turn it over to you for the rest of the meeting. And I thought we'd start with introductions again. We have a couple new people. And any information that you want to share with the group.
My name is Tom Castillo, and I am the site manager from Mount Vista Arboretum and the caretaker out there as well. And I'm also a property owner on the group.
And more with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm here as a resource, the regional rep, and I sort of make sure Springfield's following our statewide planning program with goals and administrative rules.
Nicole Ankeny, I'm a landscape architect for Willamette Lane Park and Recreation District, and so I'm here to learn about the process and see what we're going to do as we move forward, and obviously our interest is parks and recreation.
I'm Gail Lant, and my husband Martin Jones and I own 33 acres on South CB Loop, which we're running as a horse boarding facility.
My name is Tom Skates. I live on Tribute Road. I'm within the proposed UGB, and I'm here to try to help make it look nice and neat when everybody wants.
My name is Dorothy Helmer. I've been a resident of CB Loop for about 25 years and a longtime user of Buford Park facilities.
Corbin McBride, student at LCC. Residents of Springfield, and just love that area out there.
I'm Ross Penhelgen with OSU Extension Service, and been involved in agriculture, well, Lane County for 24 years and agriculture for 50.
I'm Mark Rust, I'm with Lane County Land Management Division, here as a resource.
Jim Strong, landowner off the CDU.
I'm Dan Terrell with the office of Bill Close. We represent the Willamette Water Company that provides water to the CB Loop area, and I'm here as a resource.
My name is Cecile Hayworth. I'm a property owner on Twin Buttes Road in the study area.
I'm Max Heffley. I'm with Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, or LRAPA. I'm a permit engineer, working with industrial, commercial permitting sources, but also do rule and other matters.
I'm Lauren Sparrow, I'm the communications coordinator for Development Public Works and assisting Linda with this project.
And I'm Judy Castleman, and I am an engineering assistant, and I'm helping Linda with this project also.
As I was looking over the minutes from last week, I know that we had a little bit of a, there were a couple questions that came up that about urban reserves and rural reserves. So is there any way that you could kind of just give a really brief mention of how that process works and why we don't have that here?
Okay, first of all, I'm sorry for missing last week's meeting. I didn't get anything for it by accident, so I didn't think it was happening. So I stayed in my office. I could have made it. Okay, so urban reserves and rural reserves. Okay, first of all, there's only one place in the state that can have a rural reserve right now, and that's Portland Metro area. And so for the city to pursue rural reserves with the county, for the CB Loop area, would require legislation. And so that you could say is something you could consider, but something that would require some legislative action, and whether or not it would be successful or not is, I guess, I want to say, problematic in that it hasn't gone that smoothly in Portland. And so it could be that the experience we're having in the Portland metro area either could help solidify that concept statewide or could put it off limits to the rest of the state. So it's that's sort of a wait and see. It's experimental concept, right? It's something that could be considered. In terms of urban reserves, you know, the purpose of urban reserves is to look out 50 years from an urban growth boundary that currently exists and see what area you might want to take in. So it sort of makes the urban boundary expansion in the future a bit easier. So the way it, you could do that here, and the way it would work would be Springfield right now is looking at a 20-year, a new 20-year UTB, the one they have currently dates back to 1982 when they were first acknowledged. So it's a bit older. So to, you almost have to do, and this is what Eugene is actually doing, is do sort of a two-step if you want to consider the urban reserves. It'd be first one, identify a new UGB. And because otherwise, your 50 years starts from your current UGB. And so it may not really reflect a 50-year time period in the future. So, for example, what Eugene's going to do is first establish a new UGB for that their city, and then pursue an urban reserve look. And part of that would then be, or really sort of facilitates it ultimately, is the fact that they've collected a lot of information about the landscape around the city, that they could then go through sort of a similar process to a UGB and identify what land would then be the next set of land they would bring in for whether it be employment land or residential land. And so at, you know, at this point, that's an option, but you're really looking at what land, what other land would we want to take into a UGB in the future. It's not an exclusionary process, it's more like an inclusionary process, which then sort of sets up a more expedited system for being able to expand the UGB in the future. Because the first priority lands for UGB expansion is urban reserve area. And you really can't go somewhere else if you have an urban reserve. So, two different purposes.
Yeah, and kind of opposite.
Yeah, it is kind of the opposite, right? It's for doing really well range planning. So does that help? Okay, great.
Could you answer just in a sentence or something what the source of the struggle is with the rules and why it's important?
Well, let's put it this way. Missed expectations, the fact that some cities weren't happy with what they got included in rural reserves and what it's not. And I would say probably Washington County is probably the biggest problem child up there for that, and that when they looked through the whole entire metro area for where these rural reserves should be and selected them, some land was not, was some land was put into a UGB that they thought should be out. You know, so it's, it really gets down to sort of local politics and dynamics and that sort of thing. And it was being done at a regional scale versus on the local city scale. And so probably if Lane County and the cities in Lane County want to look at rural reserves, and if it was allowed, would be to actually take a big look at the county and say, hey, should we be looking at River Road North towards Junction City? You know, because there's some real good soils there. I mean, where should we be looking for these rural reserves? We want to say these areas are off limits for the next 50 years.
That would be more problematic than just saying one at a time, we have a proposal here. This is an area that has some unique values that fits this guideline. Let's, you know,
yeah.
You could think it bogged down politically and have the net too wide.
That's true.
Well, I was just wondering if people had reflections from the last meeting. I know it's been 2 weeks now. Again, I apologize for being out sick last week and kind of missed the meeting, but because I felt we had really good discussion last time, and I was just wondering what your takeaways from that were, maybe as a way to kind of kick this off today, what themes you felt came out of that, or...
You know, the thing that I'm having a really hard time wrapping my mind around this whole process right now is that I realize that the city has a need to grow
its urban growth boundary, and I realized that geographically and environmentally, you're kind of hemmed in on all sides. But at the same time, when I sit down and I start hearing what, you know, the neighbors and the work that's gone on in Pisgah to define really what our rural values and look at what we as a group or we as a government even could do to try to safeguard those values if the urban growth boundary does expand there, it doesn't seem like there's really any mechanism in place that would allow that beyond the political desires of that particular piece. So it seems like it's all or none, and I'm just having a really hard time finding how to engage in a productive discussion that, knowing that in order to say, okay, this could work if we had this kind of industry, but yet if somebody comes along 5 or 10 years from now and makes another proposal, it could totally change it. I don't know how to engage the discussion, and that's what I've been struggling with.
I thought last meeting was productive for me because it got a lot of different views out, and I was able to kind of mull it down and come to the conclusion that everybody's going the same way in different paths. And that, you know, I agree with the folks from CB Loop and the Pisgah area that needs to be reserved, but at the same time, Springfield's got to grow somewhere. And who knows where they're going to grow. This looks like a reasonable area to come to. It would serve their purposes for the state government. That is, to have the urban growth boundary enlarged. How it progresses, I don't know. And I agree with you. You don't know what's going to happen 50 years down the road. The fortunate part is, I'll be dust, so it won't make any difference. But people down the road, it'll make a difference to them. So how do you protect that? And I don't think you can go out 15 or 20 years and say, this is the way it's going to be. I think you can only go out and say, this is the way we think it's going to be. Because you could get, in your politics, you could get a whole one side extremes to the other and say, okay, that's the way we're going, but we don't like it anymore, so we're going this way. So I felt the meeting was very, very productive for me. I was very, very happy to be here.
Well, Tom, you're describing something, you know, the way you're thinking about it, you know, it's like you see the value of it and yet and all that. And I had some thoughts about that between 2 weeks ago from now. I'm sorry you were sick, and I don't think it was your fault, so, you know. But, you know, I just keep thinking about my mother, who worked at Glacier National Park when she was in college. It's a big adventure coming from Minnesota. My parents came here, and I was lucky to be born here in Oregon. But on the way, she went to Glacier Park for a couple of summers, and they're great memories for her. And she said that at that time, there was talk about expanding the park a little bit more. I don't know if you've been to Glacier National Park. It's very densely used, valued and loved park here in the United States, but apparently they were trying to expand the boundaries because the use was getting heavy even then. And she said lots of the people around it said it doesn't need to be bigger and it's a terrible idea and don't do it. And it's an example where they did expand the boundaries and they did decide what that. And I don't think should be a park, but I think in my own thinking, you know, people have found a way to protect that land. It's not pristine and not used. It's actually heavily used. And I was there, I think, about 10 years ago, and, you know, it looked a little worn at the time. But, I mean, you know, some people think if you try to preserve something as precious as just a few people and all that, that isn't necessarily true. So, you know, I think we're... Let's see, I think it would be fabulous if we around this table and in this room could think originally in some way. I mean, I think Linda is presenting and helping get to the table a wide range of views here. And I think that that's valuable. And I think it would be really cool if we could figure something out to meet the interests and the needs here. And I think your idea of getting people around the table and having people thoughtfully talk is what would make that possible, if it's possible.
That's great. Like Gail, I'm, you know, on that subject, I've been thinking that a lot about what's wonderful about Oregon or about this area was actually envisioned by people 40, 50 years ago and even longer, and people did look out that far. They said, this is worth, you know, doing in this way, someplace like Howard Buford Recreation Area. You look at the history of that and how long ago people were thinking about that. So I think it is incumbent on us to be the generation that, you know, steps up and looks that far ahead, at least in the broad strokes, even if the reality of what happens in the next few years is a little different. Thinking back over the last, you know, period of time since our last meeting, first of all, I should apologize for coming in late. Sorry, hard time getting away from my day job. I'm still a little stuck, and maybe this is just a factual answer that Linda or somebody can supply, but I asked late in the game last time, what is our work product? I'm still a little unclear on how what we come up with relates to the laws governing the expansion of a UGB, which seems to be a very strict process that does not allow a lot of room for interpretation. Mm-hmm. And I guess when we had a neighborhood meeting with the city of Springfield some time ago, I came away feeling like I just don't see where this fits into that. This is a great process, probably, and I was surprised and pleased to the extent to which people had a sort of common sense of things like where does this gateway to the Pisgah area begin. But I still don't know how what we're doing is going to make a difference. What I heard was that you would be reporting to the city council the results of this discussion. So this is strictly to inform their voting. I won't put words in your mouth. Can you tell me a little bit more about what we're going to get out of having done this?
Sure. So reporting back to the council is just going to be summarizing. We had 4 meetings. Here's the topics that were discussed, or maybe give them the minutes from the meeting. That's what's going to happen on March 23rd. But in the overall context, is City Springfield's 2030 comprehensive plan has what's called an urbanization element. And that is the policy element that talks about the new land that's added to the urban growth boundary through this process. It talks about what policies are going to be adopted to determine how land uses can happen in those areas before they're annexed into the city of Springfield and after they're annexed into the city of Springfield. So here's what kind of uses would be permitted under an interim zoning out there. So it's a description of how the land would be regulated in terms of land uses over the next 20 years. And so part of that policy discussion are these important policies that we're I think, leaning towards about environment, social, and all these kinds of things. And so some of what you're working on, what I'm hoping we're going to come out with this, as I stated earlier, are vision statements. And vision statements, a lot of people have an easy time thinking about what goal statements are, like what you guys submitted, John and Normandy. Those really are, to me, are goal statements. They're about values. Vision is about what you want it to be. It's about thinking out 20 years and closing your eyes and saying, you know, what would be a perfect scenario?
Give us an example of that.
So I have an example right here. I just happen to have this handy thing called the Main Street Corridor Vision Plan that our council just adopted on Tuesday night. And so we spent a year having conversations in our community about our Main Street Corridor, which is a 7.5-mile strip of land. You might think, boy, how do you do the visioning for 7.5 miles? But you know, it came down to we ended up with 3 segments of the corridor that seemed to have similar characteristics. One of the vision statements said, 20-year vision statement for Main Street. This is segment 1, couplet area. Main Street will transition to a more active mixed-use district, complementary to downtown,
as envisioned in the adopted downtown urban district design plan. It will provide a transition between downtown and an auto-oriented business corridor stretching nearly 3 miles to the east. Existing businesses will thrive while redevelopment adds small-scale commercial and office space along with new options for eating and shopping. There will be new opportunities for living near Main Street and multi-story mixed-use buildings designed to complement the neighborhood and downtown. Pedestrian-oriented design and increased mobility through walking, cycling, and transit will be emphasized. Investments in infrastructure will create an attractive streetscape featuring street furnishings, small plazas, green street stormwater facilities, and public art. Green street facilities and landscape plantings on Main Street will create a, quote, garden street for the city. So that's a vision I didn't bring in. We had all these pictures that people drew. We had artists' renditions of them. But, you know, it's a picture of what people really want to see, how they want to live. That's what visioning is. And then goals are about how you're going to get there. You know, what are the things? So, like, an example of goal statements was in the piece that Chris gave me, 5 goals for the confluence area. Goal 1, channel complexity and floodplain interaction. Restore channel complexity and floodplain interaction and allow the river to migrate through the confluence area. That's feasible. To improve habitat conditions for native fish and wildlife. Goal 3, compatible recreation and access. Provide opportunities for low-impact recreation uses that are compatible. So they're action statements.
Right.
Visions are pictures of where you want to go, and goal statements are action statements. And then implementation is all the real specifics about how you actually do that, like get funding to, you know, restore the habitat or, you know, those kinds of things.
So if I'm hearing this right, then if I was to step back and say, okay, right now we are part of Lane County, we are a rural area. So one potential goal could be we would like to stay that way because of the obvious reason that it would mean we wouldn't have to deal with the fact that politically there really is no rule that could preserve cultural values or, you know. So that's one thing. But let's just say, so you have this vision statement for the downtown corridor. A goal statement to me is a very concrete thing. If you say to a group of people, this is what it's all about, then if suddenly something changes, you know, you can go back to that and say, well, wait a minute, this was the objective. So I like goals. Visions are, if I'm hearing you right, well, this is what we'd like, this is where we want to go, but we're not exactly sure where it's going to go, and then suddenly you're here instead of there. How much actual legality does your vision statement as you put for the Glenwood Corridor carry, or is it just more words that could be politically changed at any time?
Well, visioning is where you start the planning process, because if you come in and ask people, what policies do you want, you know, what code should you have, there's nothing to bring it all
right
together. If you don't have a picture of where you want to go, how can you create the right kind of regulations that will make that condition occur?
I like the idea of the vision statement because that starts a path.
Mm-hmm.
You may not have the manpower, the funding, the resources to implement that vision right now. In politics, there's you know, this rule, you can't legislate future legislation. But a vision statement kind of gets around that. That kind of says, this is the collective view of what we would like to see this area become. I see if there was a vision statement for the C.D. Buford Park area that tells people in the future of what we hold dear and what we, the general population, would like to see. So if there was the opportunity 5 years from now to pass a bond measure to obtain more property to expand the park, that fits the vision, and that becomes kind of an action item to say, look, you know, the collective neighborhood has said that they want to expand the park to pick up, you know, land here or there, and you know, people can rally behind it, and I find this very intriguing, and we can't necessarily solve all the answers today as a single group, but if we can provide input to the vision statement, that creates a lasting impression, and that gives people in future generations to look back upon, and perhaps get some direction from. So there's no absolutes, there's no concretes, but this is probably about the best we can do.
And I just need to be clear that we're talking about the city's proposed UTV area. We're not talking about creating vision statements for Buford Park. Buford Park has its own visions. And where they began, like you said, 50 years ago, somebody sitting around the table just like this saying, you know, we need to have a vision. Here's my idea, or here's our, let's talk about it.
I use that as an example, thinking that if it was within the UGB, then you've got Willamette Lane that passes a bond measure and they have money set aside for picking up open space or park space. You know, perhaps, you know, there's all sorts of different options that pop up in different scenarios that could come to fruition.
So Linda, would you say the area that we're talking about is strictly within the bounds of the current proposed UGB boundary? So,
yes.
The location of that boundary, the potential expansion or reduction, is not within scope of what we're talking about here?
Well, not really. I mean, we have people at the table that might have input into that as we go through this process. And, you know, if we identify, for example, if someone identifies that, oh my God, there's this natural resource on this property, and you know, should that really be in the proposed UGB, or should that be left out of the UGB and left out in the county? You know, that's the kind of information that maybe would be useful. And so refinement of the boundary, I would say yes, that is on the table for this group's discussion. I mean, everything's really on the table. I can't tell you what to talk about or what not to talk about, but I can tell you what I've been charged with by my council. And what I'm hoping to get out of this process, because I know that I need to produce a final product that's going to be a draft policy element for Springfield that can have some really good policies in it that talk about what this area, what the vision for this area is, and how certain, and when you talk about cultural statements aren't part of the law, I mean, look at any comprehensive plan, it's all full of cultural statements. Our existing metro plan is full of cultural statements. It is part of it. It's not just a numbers game. Sometimes it seems that way when you're doing these buildable lands inventories and acres and sites. Mr. Penhaligan, you haven't said anything yet, but.
Well, again, I think
I've
been working with the city on UGB expansion for probably 20 years, and I think as we, maybe from the Lane County perspective, if we look west, there's nothing west. If we look north, nothing. If we look northeast, then that opens up potential, but then that runs out fairly quickly. If we look east, depending, I mean, there's some hills, before you get to Cedar Flats, that becomes questionable. And then if we look south, not a whole bunch. I mean, from the city aspect, up the creek, because there's small opportunities. And again, from the agriculture perspective, I think, again, what I've heard is that once a UGB shows up, then it takes on forever. And I think that's the worrisome, is that once you open that creek, then the whole CV loop, which again, you know, from a city, that becomes the next, look at Eugene, River Road, and they're now going across Beacon, and it's EFU. Well, we'll just change, scare the crap out of it. And so again, how effective is exclusive farm use? And again, to me, that's, again, this guy's saying we'll just change it. So it used to be extremely strong, and if that is the case, or again, to me, here's the line, here's the good ag land, here's Buford Park, we don't touch it forever unless, you know, whatever. But again, that becomes the critical portion of, I think that's fairly agreeable. Now, where the line is drawn, it becomes arguable that Buford Park, follow the road around CV Loop, 2 miles on each side, no touch or ever hole. You know, and that becomes, I think, fairly uniform discussion and agreement. But again, how do we make this, quote, fence that it cannot be crossed? You know, is it public? Is it, I don't know that. Because again, it's been fairly strong so far. But again, in Eugene, they're now saying that farm's going to be transitioned. And I don't know that process, and so that's kind of a city. You know, as the UGB expands, is it just click your fingers, that type of thing. No. But how do we, again, ensure, because this is prime, this is some of the best soil in the world. Like I say, River Road is just slowly, Santa Clara.
We've all been reading the paper this week.
Yeah, exactly.
But listen, you're misspeaking a little bit. Eugene is not expanding up north of River Road. It's going to develop an existing filbert orchard inside the current UGB.
Inside.
Okay, inside.
It had to be
added. Yeah, Eugene. Well, that's a different process.
Oh.
Okay. That's not a land use process, by the way, either. That's just a governance process. Eugene in the UGB was not looking at taking in any EFU land.
Okay.
For residential purposes, they're taking a little bit for industrial, but it's literally the ground north or just immediately west of Highway 99W up to the airport, across from, I call it, the blue trees. So, yeah, and that part is for a school, part is for a large regional park, protect the wetlands and that sort of thing, and then to meet their industrial needs, like Springfield's trying to do. So, as far as the state statutes are concerned, EFU land is sacrosanct. It is the last land you can bring in. And then when you look at ag land, you take in the least productive ag land first. And so that would be your class four, five, and six soils, and then your prime ag land, your one, two, and three, those are actually the very last ones you consider. And you have to look at everything else. So I think you can still rest assured unless somebody changes the statute that, you know, it's like what Springfield's having to do, they're having to, I'm going to say, gerrymander their UGB so that it fits the state priority of landscape.
So, Ed, how far east do you have to go from what's currently developed along I-5, you know, the shooting range and Johnson Rock Crushers, and, you know, there's some stuff there already. And so how far do you have to go east of that to get to Class 3, 2, or 1 soils?
Mostly what Springfield's bringing in is already identified as exceptional. So it's basically, if you don't have urban reserves, it's basically the first set of lands you bring in.
You know, but one thought about that is when they are so landlocked that it would seem to me it wouldn't go far for them to make an argument that because we have so little land, we're already looking at that Class 2, Class 3 soil because there's just not enough room for them to grow. This is my understanding. And so, you know, how far are they from being able to present that argument and have it begin to erode away at those soils?
Getting us back to, if you're looking at residential purposes, it'd be incredibly difficult. It's sort of like, you know, residential land, when you add it, it's like sand. So Springfield looked at this residential land partly because some said they could serve anything. And so there's some land in the hills above Thurston that literally is going to be so expensive to serve, the city probably will never bring it in. But it had to count it because some wouldn't say, we'll serve it. You know, but now with industrial land, you have a different set of factors. You got to look at your target industries, what you're looking at, what are their site needs, site requirements, and then you go through again a process. You first have to look at exception land, and then if there's nothing there that fits that need, then you start looking at what would be exception land and non-resource. Then you would look at marginal land, there isn't any on here, and then you would look at your ag land, lastly, and you start again with the least productive soils and go forward. And so as part of the analysis that Springfield would do to establish that boundary would be take a look at what the soil classes are around there. And it could be maybe, and if they're all class one, well, there isn't a choice to pick class six. So they have to land on class one. And so again, they have to just basically do their due diligence, and then their studies have to prove that they're doing using the land inside the UTV in the most efficient way possible. And we have certain guidelines that they follow for that.
Well, if I can just add a point, because I think one of the concerns people have is sort of like, how, you know, is there a hard line that gets drawn? And basically what this process is doing is drawing a hard line for the next 20 years.
Right.
This process comes back again in 20 years and the city will have to justify everything again. But once this line gets drawn, that's it for the next, you know, they may start the process 15 years from now, but it's a 20-year line.
And that's where I feel like one of the things that would help a lot of people out would be, and again, it may be outside the scope of what the city of Springfield can do, but having drawn a line, if the city can also play a role in ensuring that there is some kind of buffer, there's something that helps ensure that that line doesn't get moved in another 20 years, in another 20 years, that they can have a vision to look beyond the boundaries of the UGB and look a little farther out into the future. And I think, you know, that's the issue for a lot of people. They look at that, well, maybe a very narrow UGB makes sense, but is that sort of, you know, just creep? You know, having established it, then it grows and it grows and it grows, and you know, many years from now, when I'm also dust, you know, it's you know, much of CV Loop. There needs to be a way to look a little farther out and say, we can do this, but we can also find a long-term way to preserve what we value in this other area. So, and that's difficult, I think, from what you described, Linda, because that's in a sense getting beyond the scope of what you can do.
And you're talking about private property and what people's rights are.
When you're talking about the city of Eugene, that you know has recently, you know, looked on the north side of 30th, and you're talking about the county, and you're talking about three governmental entities, and no, doesn't appear to me that there's any good way to get a holistic view of that area and plan it out.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have a metro function that looks at the whole area.
Right, but I think when you're looking at preserving land for open space or whatever values of your group or your interests, is that it all comes down to acquisition. I mean, look at what Buford Park has done, Friends of Buford Park, and the work that's been done to acquire all that land in Nature Conservancy. So that's really what makes those kind of things happen. I lived in Boulder, Colorado, where we had a green belt, but you know, they bought up all that land around the city to make that happen.
But is there a role for the city of Springfield to help make that happen, I guess is what I'm asking, or is it just, we're going to define our boundaries and this is what we care about, end of story. I mean, I think it takes community, and it takes the two cities, and it takes the county, and it takes thinking about things like reserves and trusts, and, you know, if Springfield is solely interested in getting what it needs to fulfill this function, it's not very satisfying at some level.
And I just add that, you know, I've been reflecting a lot on this idea that, you know, it started with the RV room, where we had a group of people that came together and said, we would like to manage a piece of public land free for the people, for the people. And then it grew into another organization, the Friends of Buford Park. And then from there, we suddenly had the Nature Conservancy. And then we had a lot of community people working together, managing land owned by the people, for the people, in the betterment of the people. And it has created a culture and an environment which really, you can't compare it to anything else. And it's very unique. It has created one of the most valued and loved resources anywhere in the state. And we don't really have any rules that address it. When, you know, another light went off when you talked about the expansion. Suddenly I realized, oh, we could end up becoming part of the Willamette Lane Park District. What would that mean? You know, and it's just so everything keeps growing exponentially, and the hardest thing that I'm having is that
the more government involvement, the more rules, and the beauty of what's happening out there has been that it has been something that has been kind of growing exponentially itself, and it really has created a very valued service. And it's created a culture that, as a society, you don't have to pick up the paper to realize how special it is to have people working together and freely contributing together from all ages. And I guess that's my greatest concern. And I just, it's very unique, and I would like to see the county, the city of Springfield, the city of Eugene, the state, all come together and recognize it and begin to have that discussion. Because it's kind of, I just think it's something our culture really needs right now, and I can't get beyond that because that's been my whole life. My whole adult life has been spent immersed in it, and I just have to tell you that if we destroy that, we've taken a lot of our soul out of our city, and you don't have to look far to see that we're doing a pretty good job of that everywhere you look right now.
So if we were going to put that in a vision statement, include that with some of the things other people have said, you know, like, I'm just sitting here thinking, I mean, this would be very debate, but if you don't start with something really terrible, you can't edit it, right? So the vision would be, we'll be talking about what that corridor might look like. And one thing we could, I mean, if you're looking at a full range of options, one option is it's not, you know, part of Springfield. Then there are options that, right, you know, we might consider that make it part of Springfield. But let's see, you'd have to be able to talk about, because around this table we're hearing so much, and I'm one of the voices, about protecting CV Loop, I think that has to be in there somehow, you know. So the vision would have to have in it activities of happening in that strip, which do not degrade the quality of the lands to the east, including the agricultural lands and the park that I think is, I agree with you, is universally loved.
Well, just I think that's great, and I think that should be included in the vision. But what I've heard Linda say is she's charged with creating a report, and presently this Springfield is not looking at touching CV Loop in their UGB expansion at all. So that could be incorporated in a vision, but in her reporting to city, I don't think that's going to impact them very much, because if you look at the map, it doesn't touch anything that we've all kind of mutually agreed is the gateway to Pisgah.
Okay, so you're the perfect person to have me be more clear than I am on this. and the reason I'm going ahead and taking the time with, you know, what I would like is I think it might be helpful to some other people at the table as well. So, retain my unconditional high regard again. So I feel like that the land just east of I-5 already impacts my property to some degree. You know, there's noise from Johnson rock crushers, and there's, you know, traffic noise. I mean, to some degree, it's not too bad. I mean, my thought is, you know, how people always talk about NIMBY, not in my backyard. Well, I feel like we have in our backyard or side yard, call it our front yard, I don't care, you know, but we already have on CV Loop included some things that people need. I mean, I drive on the roads and I need rock crushers, I'm sure I do. So, let's see. But my question is, what is a reasonable amount? I mean, you just said that what is included in the map isn't on CV Loop, but then we talked last time, I think we tried to address that question, but it wasn't clear enough to get through to me. You know, like, where's the gateway to CV Loop? So, like, when are you in CV Loop? So, Jim, using that map, I mean, do you feel like the Springfield's boundaries don't go into the farmland at all at this point on CV Loop? Because I think CV Loop is
so
rural
to that
character.
Specific question, does it go into the farmland? Then, of course, it's, you know, I can't argue with the soil maps that, yes, it would go into the farmland. I see type 2 and 3 soils across what my where my property boundaries are.
Yeah.
So, yes, it does.
See, that's kind of my, that's how I, in my own mind, I think, define CB loop. So how are you doing?
Anything that's farmable.
Well, you know, if you're talking about 3, 2, and 1 soil types that close to town, there are a lot of cultural references these days, locavores, I mean, we could go into that, let's not. But it's, so, I do, yeah. Now, I know, I've heard you talk about your experience with farmland and renting it and stuff, but I think that could change. But just how would, I guess, if, so I've been defining the parts that are on that map that could be valuable agricultural land as part of CB loop. It sounds like you haven't, so where do you think CB loop begins?
So I'm not entirely certain of your question. I can see, I think I understand. I guess the point that I was trying to make for Linda is that regardless of what we say, we can talk about what we want to save and preserve. That's not really going to go into her report. That's not going to necessarily impact the city's decision that much. What they're looking at is taking in this land. Whether my vision of whether or not the impacted land that may or may not be brought into the UGB affects the rest, I think that's getting pretty argumentative, speculative, and my understanding of the UGB process is pretty black and white. It's pretty cut and dried. You know, there's not a lot of room for public input, and am I interpreting it wrong?
I was never an obedient student. I'll just say, in my vision, you know, it seems like it might be reasonable to shrink those boundaries some. And I don't know, I say that with some level of humility, because, you know, you might be able to talk me out of that one, but since it's got what I would regard as farmland in it, and this kind of farmland is precious. I mean, Oregon is a big state, but it doesn't have a lot of this kind of farmland in it, relatively speaking.
I think we have an expert here that can speak to, I mean, I just might be a really bad farmer, and I wouldn't be the first one. But I just, you know, the soil map shows the soil types. I just, you know, you can, you know, with the proper amount of chemicals and water, you can make a lot of things.
Or in my case, horse manure.
Horse manure. I mean, you
yeah, can I can do good things. Stuff with that. You can't beat with chemicals, but keep going.
And I think these soil maps, I mean, they're close, but the boundaries, like everything, can be flexible. I think they're probably close, but there's not as much farmable land south, closer to CB Loop, you know, the recent purchase.
North CB Loop, are you talking about?
Right, you know, it's not touched in the UGB, but the last 25 acres I bought a couple months ago, that I agree is type 2. That's great. I've got that, you know, planted right now in grass seed and it's growing well as long as we can keep the geese off of it. But it's the stuff south of that is, you know, Carl Drews, he lives on the loop. He's been a farmer there for his entire life. And
he used to farm our place.
Right. And he's been trying to farm this land for 30 years. And he says, Jim, it's a waste of diesel. You know, I can't get anything to grow out there. You know, without pumping it full of fertilizer and a lot of it. It just, so I think, you know, experts can tell us what's available out there, and you know, I'm sure you don't remember me. I've talked to you on the phone many times, saying, "What am I doing wrong here? What can we do?" You know, and you know, I think it was you. There aren't too many, but I've got some other ag land around that I said, "Look, I can't get farmers. I can't pay farmers to farm this for me. You know, how do I use this land? I don't want it to just become a blackberry bush." And you've given me some excellent resources on how to reach out to different farmers in different venues and how to make it appealing to them and stuff. But it's difficult. It's difficult to own land and
I work pretty hard
not
on
let
three
it
acres
go fallow. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
You can't stop.
Right.
Can I ask for a clarification? I mean, this is going to sound anyway. So if I'm hearing this right, you know, when I hear this discussion, I think the urban growth boundary taking in all of CB Loop to the river, to Goshen, ultimately I see that's where it, the direction is probably going. But yeah, so I see you shaking your head. This is good. This is really good to see. Because what I really want to clarify then is that as part of this industrial zone process, it is defining the boundary as you have drawn as being the area that would become part of Springfield, and everything else doesn't change.
That's correct. And it wouldn't become part of Springfield per se until it's annexed and developed. So it would be part of the Springfield Urban Growth Boundary, which means a property owner could request annexation, and they could develop the property after they do a bunch more.
After the industrial zone?
After it's in the boundary.
Okay, at some point, I would love to have a discussion on that, because I don't, with anybody who could just educate me about that, because it's interesting to hear this, because I just need to learn more.
For an example, Linda knows I've got 30 acres out off of Thurston Road in Springfield that's been within the UGB, Springfield's UGB, for 35, 40 years. It's not annexed. I still try to grow stuff on it. It's a big field and it sits there, but there isn't industrialization around it. But it's been in the UGB for I think as long as I've owned it. My father's owned it.
The other good example right now, you just talked about the filbert orchard on River Road. Right. It's been in the Eugene City urban growth boundary for a long time. They're just now annexing it to the city limits so that they can develop.
So the property owner itself is the one that decides when it gets annexed? That's interesting.
And we're counting their properties as buildable lands in our inventories, even though they might have no intention of doing anything in the next 20 years. We're counting on that. If it's not constrained by slopes or wetland or some other thing,
it was interesting to hear, though, it had to be annexed before it would even be considered. I did catch that, though.
That's another step. But also, in order to take in Pisgah and the old Wilder sites into the UGB, they would have to show a need. I think it would be difficult.
Why
would
we? Well, it's floodland. I mean, look at the flood map. So, I mean, that's going to restrain you. A good deal when you look at the FEMA floodway and the FEMA floodplain. So.
Yeah, so I think at one point a discussion on, you know, how difficult, I mean, in other words, if we could go to the community and say, you know what, folks, most likely this is not ever going to be brought in because it puts people's mind at...
Is your property on the floodplain?
Floodplain, not floodway, I think. I haven't seen the current maps.
So it's 100-year floodplain
on the big map.
There is some of it, but nothing within the UGB really touches, or their proposed UGB.
Yeah.
But if you look at the rest of the loop, I mean, a large portion of it is in the floodway, which is very restrictive and is getting even more restrictive. I mean, there's nothing we can do to change the floodway, really.
And if you want a 100-year or 50-year hard, fast line that this isn't going to be developed, to me, the floodway is a pretty good line to say. Mm-hmm. Guess what? You're never going to develop that at an urban density.
I mean, from a development standpoint, even if you could obtain insurance in a floodway, it's going to be so astronomical that a business can't afford it.
I know that one.
Yeah.
I just want to get back. So Gail was starting to try to come up with some vision statements, and she said activities in the strip. So she's talking about one way to start a vision statement for the area that we're talking about in the green is she's calling it the strip. I'm assuming that's what you mean.
Well, I guess I mean, you know, what you're proposing for this urban growth boundary. So
right.
The strip is fine with me.
Yeah. So
it's
zooming in to what we're really talking about. We're not talking about Buford Park. We're not talking about your farm. We're talking about the strip or the green area.
We are talking about the strip, but how it relates to my farm.
Yes.
It is specifically about the strip.
Exactly. You got it.
I don't necessarily take offense to the word, but how about corridor?
Make Linda write more letters. I can see the newspaper headlines now.
Yeah.
So do not degrade, you didn't really say, do not degrade rural character?
Immediately to the east.
I would, I mean, maybe this is asking too much, but I'd say things like noise, light, runoff, you know.
Including blah, blah,
yeah.
So those are negative statements.
Right.
And next week we're going to talk about code and more about zoning, and that's where you get into that kind of stuff.
Okay. So
how can you make that into a positive statement?
So if we wanted to say that positively, activities in the corridor retain the high quality of the rural landscape character. Everybody feel free to improve all that.
I know you indicated that the vision that a group of neighbors and others submitted to the process was, you know, part of it is values, but mm-hmm. there's a second half of that, which is a little bit more, mm-hmm. you know, along these lines. I mean, there's the preserve and enhance the beauty of the CB Loop neighborhood as a gateway to Mount Pisgah. There's also preserve, increase in diversified, sustainable agriculture. I just wanted to try those phrases on. Those are closer to what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, and you can make those into a positive statement just by changing the verb, right? So what was the first one? Preserve
and enhance the beauty of CB Loop neighborhood as a gateway.
How about the gateway itself? Mm-hmm. We can refine these later, just
there were really just three bullets of this mm-hmm. sort.
Yep.
The second one was to preserve sustainable agriculture.
So how can that relate to the green area? How can what happens in the green area relate to that? Or support that? Or
do that again, Doug.
Preserve, increase, and diversify sustainable agriculture.
Activities in the corridor maintain the option for
promote industrial activities that benefit or
benefit and complement.
And back to sustainable agriculture.
So like rooftop farming or just
growing weed out there.
I'm serious. We're thinking a 20-year plan, remember. People are already doing it right now in cities. And let me make sure I get this. Promote industrial activities that benefit and complement
sustainable agriculture. I guess the third one, not to dominate all your time, would be the, you know, again, to promote activities that protect and improve water, soil, air, and wildlife habitat.
Protect? Is that the right word?
Protect and improve water, soil, air, and wildlife habitat.
You getting all this, Judy?
I am.
Thank you.
I'd like to change the second one. Instead of putting sustainable is a quasi word, where let's say just good agricultural practices, which have a specific definition. Sustainable is a, it's a nice word, but it, what does it mean? If you say good agricultural practice, ching, it comes right down to very specific types of things.
I like the way you think.
Would you say good farming?
Just good agriculture, good ag practices is what it's called. Sustainable is a, it's a whole.
What does that mean? You said that.
Sustainable. I mean, there's no definitions to sustainable. It can be pulling one weed from the field is a sustainable practice versus what we're really after is good agricultural practices.
I believe
agreed upon today.
No area of expertise. Yeah. Good.
We'll refine this later.
Defined as sustainable.
Sustainable is just overused, and without good definition.
I was going to say promote alternative transportation. Or good transportation?
Good.
I mean, it makes sense.
Which one is it?
Carbon something.
Could be multimodal.
I don't know. I mean, I think good. I like good.
At least consider the process.
So what do you mean by good transportation?
Well, in this case, I think of things that would be less polluting,
not efficient,
less congestion, less traffic congestion,
efficient and effective,
and maybe less noise. Well, I guess that's polluting.
Well, I'd say direct service by bike pathways and LTE.
I don't see how you're going to stop the noise of the freeway.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to stop the noise by the freeway. I think that's going to continue. And, you can reach a certain level where things are intolerable and you have to
It's going to be interesting to hear what the roadway design is, because I think part of the discussion that I would love to see is the vision of how the trucking corridor is created. You got Goshen, you got everything, you know.
Yeah, but that's not going to be nearly as loud as the freeway is now. I mean, you get, I don't know how much noise you guys get in the mornings.
I'm at Pisgah and I hear it all. It's a parabola, but
between
neither here nor there.
Between Short Mountain and the noise, you know, you woke up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning every morning.
Particularly
in the summertime, we got the windows open. Well, now we go close the windows because it's cold.
Now we hear it too. You've got a hill by you as well.
But I think part of it is you know, we have to accept what's there, but what are we adding to it? I mean, I know it's not something that bothers me a lot, but I hear neighbors who hear the clanging of metal at JCI and hear and see the lights on at night and all of that. And if you have more of those instances across the area, you're just adding to, even though you're right, I-5 isn't going anywhere.
Well, even if the UGB comes in, you're going to have businesses come in. They're going to have lights. Hopefully, they don't have noise, but they probably are going to have noise.
There are ways point lights and shade lights.
I want to add something about aesthetics. Promote aesthetic design or. A beautified corridor, or just, I don't know how to say it. We don't want it to be an ugly, industrial, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have language in the Main Street
corridor. No ugly buildings.
Yeah, we have a lot of this throughout existing policy,
sure.
But again, think, remember 20 years, who knows what.
Does any of this restrict agricultural use of the land? Well, I was thinking of is from, if it's farming, what about fish farming, tilapia farming? What about, I own farmland other than here, and in other areas, it's not uncommon for us to get noise complaints called in on our farmers because they like to start early in the summertime. And people get upset when they're woken up at 5:30 by tractors driving around in a field. And so we fight that as well, saying, you know, we've been farming this for a long time. You moved into our neighborhood. But there's a, but I guess, you know, I've read reports about, you know, fish farming, tilapia farming, greenhouses, you know, other things that, that are, you know, may or may not be allowed under current zoning. But would that affect the rural character of the neighborhood if there was some intensive use in it? You know, claiming from JCI is one thing. You know, if you know, we started intensively growing row crops out there, does that also increase the noise pollution?
That wouldn't worry me. I would say, you know, some huge dairy, you know, where the cows are 3 feet apart, or...
I mean, well, not a possibility for me.
You know, I would
I've done my time milking cows.
My number one read on that is a farming designation, and that is zoned for that already. So guess what? If you live out there, you deal with the tractor. You
but the vision statement is kind of defining that moving forward. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, mm-hmm. I guess from my skeptical mind, I'm saying, does this further restrict what rights I already have? If I want to continue farming...
Not compatible with that... Not compatible with farming or agriculture or the current use, maybe it could be said, something to that nature.
We have a right to farm law in Oregon, don't we?
You would think so.
I think we actually
We do.
And tilapia is a little bit of a concern, especially well, near the floodway.
See, he has the right to farm, but again, if you if it becomes a corridor, see, that's another set of parameters.
Uh-huh.
That becomes, that's, then it's exactly. double whacked. Because that's now, he's doing A, but this now has become a B.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if it could be just, you know, until it becomes developed, it remains A.
Right.
Because, yeah, you're double whacked.
No, actually, statute trumps local ordinance, so it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's an interesting, I'm really glad you brought this up, because a lot of people don't like want to hear this because they're living in the rural area next to farms, but the research and the data show that it's more compatible to have agriculture next to employment, industrial kinds of uses, than it is to have agriculture next to residential uses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the data that's out there because of the complaints, you know, noise, they're out there spraying, you know, whatever, so.
Well, sadly, the industrial runoff usually goes through the agricultural drainages, which I don't know that that's always good, but.
Right. But there are other, like you're saying, there's other threats to agriculture.
Is this an appropriate place, or again, I'm not sure if it's within scope, but there's a one of the issues is the impact on the property value of properties that are not within the UGB but are near it. So, you know, it's the issue being if you have a residence. And it makes a difference to the value of that residence, whether it looks out on a, you know, beautifully designed building or an open field or the back of a Walmart or a, you know. So is it appropriate to say that the uses enhance or preserve the value of neighboring properties? I know that's outside of the UGB though. It's like the you know, it's like the externalities in an economic model. You did this here,
mm-hmm.
you're going to affect things around it. Is there a way to state that in a useful way?
Well, I think this starts to get at it about aesthetically pleasing design, or you know, buffering gets at that. If you have vegetated buffers or other means, if you're talking about how traffic's going to flow in and out of an area and how that might impact.
You could add fuchsia to that as a value. You know, your the view shed is mm-hmm. recognizing what's there. I mean, whether it be planting a line of tree to buffer something, mm-hmm. an ugly looking building, but it's just maintaining, respecting the view shed.
How about aesthetically pleasing design that preserves the view shed? But then you have to
preserves or enhances.
You have to define where these view sheds are. I know that in our Gateway Refinement Plan, which is pretty old now, that there's policies in there about protecting view sheds to the McKenzie and all that.
We talked a lot about this at the last meeting, the idea of the experience of leaving the park and not looking into the back of whatever. And it's just, it's the same thing. It's preserving the rural character, I guess. The rural view.
Is there anything that would prevent a high-rise building of some sort being built in this UGB?
Well, when we get into the code later on about building heights, I mean, there could be policies. Those policies wouldn't come into play until actually we do more refined level of planning.
Right.
But that's where you get into how tall buildings can be.
When I've been thinking about that, you know, say Springfield does include it in your UGB, if that happens, it would be possible to have buildings along there that would reflect back some of the noise from I-5 westward, and that would be good, in my opinion. I don't know if you could ever get the agreement to build in that way, but it would, you know, if they were a certain, I mean, in Salem, for example, they have those big walls along I-5 in that area, and my mother lives kind of near there, so I know something about how those walls actually help. If the buildings are too high, then you know, maybe they're an urban statement in a place with rural character. If they're high enough, maybe they reflect noise. I mean, you know, those are questions like that.
Well, if this land is brought into the UGB, it will eventually have urban character. I just want to be really clear about that. And it might be a very distinctive area that has certain parameters that have to do with building heights or colors or sound ordinances or anything else, but it will be urban.
Oh, I get that.
It won't be a rural.
But will it be urban with 15 stories, or will it be urban with 3 or 4?
Right.
You know, I realize industrial means development and hardscape and parking lots and cement and all that.
Yeah, and to give an idea of what industries are looking at now is in that your packet, that report that's called Industry Intelligence. It talks about building heights for these different uses and how much parking they need. So you can start to get an idea of today, these are the kind of uses that are looking for sites. Doesn't mean these will be the ones in 20 years, but this is what these industries are needing now, and that's why we're proposing to bring this area in to provide sites for those industries.
I mean, as an example, all we have to do is look across the river and see about the public input process, how effective that can be to alter proposed development plans. You know, if I've seen many things coming out of your guys' office that you know, once they have a public hearing about it, Eugene, that the neighbors will impact what the future design of that is, be it less structures per acre, be it, you know, a smaller height, you know, they have to deal with solar impacts. I mean, there's all sorts of processes that can influence what the eventual design is. And I think the hard thing is us looking at what current industry is looking at, but we're looking 20, 30 years from now. And I mean, 20, 30 years ago, we couldn't have envisioned what they'd be doing now. I mean, who would have thought a green roof, you know, on an industrial building? Who knows what they'll have 30 years from now?
Yes, and you made the point earlier today in our meeting that if you have a vision statement, it may be useful 20 years from now as people try to figure out what the rules are going to be and why.
Exactly. I see that as being a lot more flexible. Vision.
When I was saying, well, 3 or 10 or something, I was just trying to communicate something sort of clearly. I didn't recommend those parameters necessarily. And, you know, there are even buildings that have plants all over them that, you know, might be interesting to see. I mean,
well, that's, to me, that's a vision. When you said something about buildings being a wall along I-5, I'm starting to see a picture in my mind of that. I don't know if it's feasible or if it would work, but I'm starting to see a picture. So to me, that's vision. It's what if, you know? What could it be?
And as we become a little less defensive, we may be able to get a little better at what if. And we also can't forget how much we care. I don't, we're probably not in any danger of that.
One thing I noticed on this soil diagram that I have a little problem with, I'm in, I think, three soil. Well, I've got hard rock on the surface. How do I get to that three soil?
I think this was their best guess, given topographic maps and floodplains and stuff.
Go down where you are, yeah, it's good soil.
Right, I mean, that, you know, I doubt they went out and did soil sampling.
Actually, they did.
Did they?
1952. Oh, yeah. The soil survey is 99.5% accurate. I've not had one inaccuracy in 30 years.
Wow.
Not a single inaccuracy. It's that close. They spent a lot of time. Our soil survey is amazingly accurate.
Wow.
Amazingly accurate.
Well, maybe the half inch that's on some of the hard rock was good soil.
Yeah.
You have a unique geologic area there.
Oh, yeah.
That whole Goshen.
Yeah, Twin Buttes is a weird place.
It is. Ecologically, it's kind of unique.
Yeah. But that's one reason why I'm kind of for this, because we know that I don't have really good soil.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I can, you know, pat myself on the back and say, I'm sacrificing my area for your area.
You know, getting back to this visioning, the other thing that I'm thinking about, and I don't know how to phrase it, but it's this idea that we have all of this community group activity. For instance, you know, I'm excited to have JCI on board, because for me, hiking Pisgah at night, I see their lights all the time. And so it's like, I want to say create community-based opportunities for people to kind of communicate some of these values and look for opportunities to help enhance the needs of all those involved, whether it be from the industrial point of view or the community point of view, but just, you know, create this community-based, I don't know, gathering of the minds, visioning or whatever. Because I love the fact that I can sit in a room now with these guys and say, you know, great plant maybe, but change your lighting. It would make it. I'm going to take that guy up on the hill. I'm going to show him the lights.
And you're right. I mean, if nothing less,
right.
This has, the whole process is served to kind of bring the neighborhood closer.
And I'm happy for that.
I didn't know my neighbors as much as I did now.
And
I grew up out there. But you're right. I mean, JCI, Jeff, I mean, that building's been there for a long time, but through this process, if they can hear about some things that would make them a better neighbor, I don't see why they would not implement it.
If you get him out there at night, and I think he's a hiker, he'll see it too.
to that point, I live there where Walsh is, and they, on the east side of their building, they put either 8 or 10 high-intensity lights.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're on at night, I can read a newspaper in the house. Mm-hmm. And Tom Walsh was at the very first meeting we had, and I talked to him. And except for one weekend, they've been on.
There you go.
What happened was somebody that's coming in, doesn't know where the lights are, flipping all the switches on at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they forget to turn them off when they leave.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen anymore. So to your point, now secondary on that, there are, particularly in Springfield, I think Eugene, there are codes for light
pollution.
Yeah. And you're simply putting up a screen. And it's be a lot better to talk to the people at JCI about that. JCI doesn't bother me.
Right.
He probably does, but JCI doesn't.
I can see so much value for, you know, groups like Friends and the Arboretum sitting down and saying, well, you know, we'd love to have owl walks and night walks, and lighting is a big deal for us, you know. And people start to learn, and then industry and uses can evolve as a community instead of in a vacuum.
That's where having a vision comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I always try to look long range, and in your concerns, I don't see this as great a risk as, you know, the Evanooks deciding that they want to sell their property and nobody wants to farm it, and they pump down a few houses. I mean, that does more to destroy the rural character that you're trying to preserve than anything the city's proposed. But having a vision statement that kind of incorporates the values of this entire area and allows the public to rally behind some sort of funding source to preserve that area would be useful. Plus, it gets us all talking about it.
Other vision.
Hi, Steve. I keep coming back to basically a fear that, you know, that we can sit here and we can have discussion that can be incorporated into what Springfield does in the UGB, but Springfield is still a completely separate entity, and, you know, those of us who live in the CV Loop area, you know, we don't have a hand in electing the commissioners, or we don't have any, you know, direct influence over what the city of Springfield is going to do, except that we're sitting here, you know, as participants, but, you know, I can't control what Eugene's going to do. I have no voice in Eugene. I have no voice in Springfield except what you're offering me here. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of voice in Lane County because we've got the one commissioner who represents our area. So I feel really powerless to, you know, to make a case to take to somebody that's going to actually do something about it. And I... The entities that own the parklands and the Nature Conservancy and all that, you know, I can call up their directors and talk to them and have a good conversation. But none of them are pulled under, you know, a single umbrella where we can come to a table and really affect change that's going to be codified. And, you know, my neighbors are private landowners, and that's great, and I don't really want all of CV Loop to become part of a park. I really like having the farms there. So we have a very strange character to our neighborhood. We have this amazing parkland resource, and it still profoundly bothers me that we don't have a way for everybody who's really invested to be mandated to come together and craft something that will, you know, do more than address the UGB growth, but it will really integrate the UGB goals and vision with the CB neighborhood goals and vision and the parkland goals and visions and the county goals and visions. You know, this is a really extraordinary place, and it shouldn't be so much on the backs of a few landowners to be running around at meetings saying, oh, we have to do something because this is special, and, you know, enforce different agencies into the same room talking about each other. I worry about that.
There is a tool available to you. Mm-hmm. It's called the city and the county, it would call a joint management agreement.
It's called
what? A joint management agreement. And they're required to have one under state law. My agency does review those.
Joint what?
Management agreement.
What is the tool available to me as a property owner to speak out here? I've come to two sessions and haven't been allowed to speak at all, and it's incredibly frustrating to me to listen to all of your concerns about what's going to happen, how you're going to be affected, and yet I haven't even had the opportunity to speak out. This is, you know, there's a whole group of people here. Every single one of these pieces of property is owned by someone. And I feel like this group is making a decision about us without our input. And it's extremely frustrating to me. And the interesting thing is that I agree with many of you. And I have ideas about how we could come together and solve the problem. And especially, John, you mentioned the issue of individual property and ownership and buying it. I see a possibility that the urban growth boundary has changed. I'm living there. Somebody comes in next to me, and they put up some industry.
and I still have my property. So I would like you all, I can't come again. This was my last chance to get away from work. But I would ask that all of you consider taking a next step and including all of the neighbors, at least having a session where we can talk with you. I have a vision. My vision is not industry on my property. I have no doubt that someday the growth boundary will change and people will come in and buy it. My fear is they buy Tom's land. And I'm stuck with all of the concerns that all of you guys have, which are real concerns. And one of them is the noise. We live in a bowl. You guys all know that. Anything that happens anywhere in our little natural amphitheater, we all hear. There's so many concerns that there's, you know, there were issues that were brought up. John said, what about taking our land and dedicating it to employment land or something and having a corridor and moving on down to Goshen and let that be the industry? I think that that the people who are truly vested, like Tom and I mean, this is a big deal. This is our land. This is scary. You know, last summer my grandsons came and they played all day. And the 8-year-old, after swimming, fishing in the pond, running up and down the road, visiting Tom and Vicki, said, Grandma, you guys have the best property of anybody, don't you? We do. So I need to leave. I need to go back to work. But
tell us your name.
Cecile Hayward.
Get on the list.
But I would, you know, the committee or the working group was full, and I couldn't get a place on it. But I, you know, I have a vision, and it's not industry next to me. Even though I agree, Walsh Trucking has been a good neighbor by and large. So thank you for listening to me.
What's next to you?
I'm sorry?
What's next to you is not industry. What's next in your vision? What's next to you?
In my vision, I will tell you what my vision is. Thank you for asking. Last summer, I was at Peace Health at River Bend. My daughter has a serious medical condition, and at that point, we thought it was morphing into something life-threatening. So I went to the doctor with her, and I was standing on the third floor of River Bend trying to entertain my 5-year-old grandson. And I looked out, and across the river, I saw people bucking hay. And it was so comforting to me. It was, I can't even put into words how that put me at ease. That's my vision of our property, is that we can get somebody in there, a medical facility, a research institute, who knows what, where they keep the property intact. None of us have to worry about it being subdivided into individual parcels where we're living next door to a tire factory or something, where the character of our community is intact. And I worry about the issue that John already brought up of the right of individuals to buy up the property, because they're going to be individual parcels. And anything could happen, unless in the vision, and what I think needs to happen is everybody that owns that property needs to come together. And we need to put forth a vision that I think would, by and large, be the same vision as the vision here. Because we're all living there because of the environment, because of the landscape. So I think that it would be possible for the property owners to come together, echoing the vision, maybe work with a real estate person, work with Linda or another city planner, work with some of the other resource people, and say, we as a group, this is what we see. This is what we see for this property. We want to maintain the character of it. We do not want it to affect our neighbors, because we know, Tom and I know, what it's like to have an industry right down the street from you. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that happen to you, and I don't want to see it happen individually to any of us. So that's my vision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
You should get around the list, John.
Just so everyone knows, all the property owners have been invited to all these things that we've been doing from the very beginning.
I think that's what the problem is. Most people just want to be there.
Or they have to work, or it's a hard time.
Yeah. I mean, some of the mail does come back. If people don't have a mail receptacle, you know, they might not know about it. That's why I've asked folks, let people know that this stuff's happening, because I can't really go door to door. I kind of tried that, and it didn't work very well.
You know, and she brings to a really interesting point, and we touched on it the last time we were here, and that's this idea that while, you know, so what I've heard is the Sea Relief area, really urban growth boundary, most of it's floodway, really not going to be able to put too many houses on. So this is what I've heard. What I've heard is industrial land, we're talking about a little spit, which really is not that many acres, that College View Road and a portion of 99 up to Goshen. You know, the city of Springfield says they need industrial land, but how crucial is it for the city to have this industrial land in order to be a city? And when I look at places such as Crestwell and other areas that could grow industrial land, it really begs the question for me, which is, you know, do we really need to make sure every city has, you know, subscribes to this? Or could you as a city just say, you know what, we're not going to grow this way. We're not going to do it this way. Or we're going to create a commercial zone through here that's not going to be an industrial zone. It's just, which will help preserve the values that I think everyone agrees upon in this room are worth considering. It's just, you know, when you talk about an industry and you talk about big buildings and noise, and nobody wants industry next to them. It's just, you know, but then when you take a community as unique as the one we've described, it seems doubly offensive to it. And I think we're going to keep hitting that ball.
I'm planning to study the list of industries on your page there between this meeting.
Okay. But there's also another point. Springfield needs to enlarge their urban growth boundary because of state laws. Is that correct?
You're supposed to have it 20 years.
You're supposed to have one. They don't have it. They need it. Okay, I can see them going ahead and getting this urban growth boundary. We've done our part. We're done. We're not going to do anything. Somebody comes in and wants to start buying lots of land, well, we may help them, but we've done our part. We're done. It just remains the same way it is.
That's a very valid point. I mean, all of us have seen the studies that show that in order for this area to be developed, it would require incredible amounts of money. The city can bring this into the UGB and fit their mandate, but then the reality of this being developed, you know, who's going to walk in with, what was the last estimate, $70 million? Who's going to walk in and say, I need something so bad here that I'm going to spend $70 million before I even put a shovel in the dirt to build my building? I mean, not that doesn't preserve it forever, but that creates a buffer of time before anything can happen.
Yeah.
Well, you ought to see my adorable grandchildren.
You know, and from my perspective, when I look at that area, it's inevitable that we're going to have growth out there. We cannot stop it. I mean, down to Goshen, I mean, if you look at all the projections, all of the studies, everything, but the question here is, what is the appropriate development? The city needs industrial ground. We get it. And we get that it is located in the right way, but defining it as industrial ground is probably the biggest offense you could put on that stretch of road. Define it as commercial ground, you know, low, in a manner that has some elevation criteria or something. It's just hard.
Can a vision restrict which industrial things, or you zone it industrial, and if the business is an industrial business, and it fits, they can just come in and build.
The zoning would tell which uses could be and which ones couldn't.
But the zoning comes after.
Yes.
And the target industries list that's in your packet, again, that doesn't mean that those are the only industries that we're going to get. It just means these are some targeted ones that we'd like to be able to have in our community.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that all those uses would be in new land that was added to the UGB. A lot of those uses could locate within the existing boundary. But some uses do need larger sites. Some uses need sites with good access to Interstate 5. And so those are the kinds of uses that would, we think, be interested in that area.
If the vision that has come up with is incompatible with the full use of all of that space for industry, that leaves you short. What does the city do with that?
Well, I guess we'll see where we go from there. But that's not kind of where I'm feeling that we're going with this.
Well, I guess I started by asking if you know, the line for the UGB was on the table,
uh-huh.
And I believe you said yes, so I guess my vision would include probably a smaller
mm-hmm.
smaller footprint than that. I'm not actually against having it narrowly
yeah.
defined down the corridor
mm-hmm.
there, but that doesn't get you the land that you need.
Sure.
Right. I think what's on the page now is too expansive, so a vision would be a more narrowly defined corridor.
Mm-hmm. Well, everyone has a map in your green folder that I gave you last week, so feel free to mark it up where you think the line should be if you don't think it's in the right place. And hopefully you'll have a rationale for why you think it should be changed.
But this is not a vision that's qualifies for being written on the flip chart?
I don't see that as something to write on here, but if you'd like to write it, you can. I'm seeing it as something you'd want to draw on a map.
Well, it's going in the minutes as well, probably,
mm-hmm.
right? What John has just been saying.
I guess what I'm saying is, you have responded that part of the vision can involve different boundaries, and having proposed a concept of different boundaries as part of the vision, it evidently doesn't qualify to be written on the charts. You really only want to talk about what's in the current written boundaries.
You tell me you'd love to write on the chart whatever your vision statement is.
My vision would be for a more narrowly defined UGB corridor in the present plan. It may not be a shared vision, but
can you describe that more?
More defined than
geographically, I think she asked.
Geographically?
No, not at this moment.
Okay.
But then
think
I probably
about
could not define an aesthetic value either, or some of these other things.
Yeah.
And I would say my vision would be for a commercial zone instead of an industrial zone.
I never thought I'd hear you say that, Tom.
Does Springfield need more commercial land?
I think that's probably the issue that they're going to get at, is they're being mandated because they don't have the requirements for industrial. So that's why they're looking to expand UGB.
So they don't even need commercial.
They don't need commercial, they don't need residential.
So
I think the thing to sit back, I mean, one of the things I hear Tom saying, do you think that commercial has less of an impact than industrial?
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to tell you, from driving around the country and driving 7 miles of Main Street, sorely mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I need to rescind that. In fact, I do.
I mean, I worked for 6 years in Southern California for the city of Irvine, California, which is a totally planned community. It has an incredible amount of industrial land that is better than anything you've ever seen probably in the state. Okay. It is possible to design and develop attractive industrial areas. And quite frankly, most of the industry today does not pollute. It is not smokestack. Stuff is going to occur inside a building. to me, the more critical case is, what is the view from the road? How is it landscaped? What does it look like as you drive through it? What types of materials do they use? To me, there's nothing more offensive than a metal Butler building. It says temporary. Yeah, it just isn't going to last very long. So one of the things you can look at is, do we want to have some kind of architecture controls? Do we want to have, would it be good to have some kind of material requirements? You know,
kind of CCNRs for.
It's not CCNRs. What it is you actually build it into the city's code. You don't need CCNRs. You can have design requirements inside a city code. The city could develop a specific industrial district for this area that has those, so it doesn't affect the rest of the city. So you can create a sense of place, a sense of industry, you know, that fits the environment that you're in, fits, you know, the Buford Park, Mount Pisgah environment, and the CB Loop environment. So, I only say that as a cautionary note, to don't be fixed to thinking that, you know, commercial is less impactful than industrial, or the commercial is going to be more attractive than industrial, because I can tell you, we've got thousands of miles of roads in America that are butt ugly, and they're all commercial.
You just said it's valuable to me, you know, I'm just trying to sit here, I worry about this beautiful place, you know, so I try not to be a victim of my fears, but rather, you know, and that is all very useful. Normandy talked, you could say, to sum it up, hopefully maybe a little bit accurately, about feeling vulnerable. You know, we say, all right, great, industrial, and we want it to be, you know, sort of look like Carmel, California, but just industry, you know, same deal. And then we get, you know, later something that makes us weep. So it's challenging. If we can figure out how to agree to something that does meet the interests and the needs of a vigorous economy and really does indeed protect this beautiful place, that'd be win-win.
Well, that's where you start with the vision statement that Linda's working on right now. The vision statement would then guide sort of the goals and objectives and policies that are going to affect this area, and will eventually inform the implementation of regulations that are to go in. And
how effective of a guide is that usually, often, you know, in your experience?
Well, the thing is, before I think the city even adopts the UGB, part of what will happen is Linda will take the vision statement and convert those into goals, objectives and policies, goals and policies that are going to get embedded in their comprehensive plan. And then that is what guides the implementing regulations.
That works.
For everybody sitting around the table saying, you know, my worst fear, how do I avoid my worst fears? Is one, plugging in like you are now, and working with Linda and the city on the vision statement, and also staying plugged in and possibly helping inform the development of the goals and objectives and policies in the comp plan. Now you have something tangible that when that gets adopted along with that UGB, that now informs everything else that comes after.
Because, I mean, sitting in my chair, it's
it's frightening.
What?
It's frightening for you, I'm sure.
Well, comes and goes. I love CB Loop, but, you know, like you can love a place, and then I also don't want to betray my other neighbors who love it just as much as I do. And that, you know, to me personally, like to think that I participated in this and then I betrayed them, that would... I'd really be up nights on that one.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
These guys didn't even get to say anything. So Max, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, no, I didn't want to stifle the good conversation, but like I said, there are a couple of things to point out from an air quality perspective. Should that UGB be expanded, typically there are more stringent requirements for industry and residents, residential use, residential use as far as backyard burning and home heating. Currently, the city of Springfield has an ordinance that lots greater than half an acre in size or more can do backyard burning of their woody yard debris generated on site. If that was, you know, the UGB was expanded, that could provide additional restrictions. restrictions on the backyard burning, as well as home with heating should be up a red day. Sometimes we have issued advisories for GB portions. Just a couple things to consider there. But as far as industrial, it would increase the likelihood that a source would have additional controls or additional monitoring required if they were to be located in a UGB. We have typically our air quality management areas are matched those UGB boundaries.
Can I ask a question that has, relates to this, but it is the Seneca biofuel plant, do they fall under the same guidelines of no burn day? I mean, you have an industrial use that has come in and put more pollution into our airshed, and, you know, do they have to abide by the same standards as we?
Yeah, the no burn days typically are for the backyard burning and home with heating advisories. So industrial sources, typically it's less efficient to have a source, say, shut down for 12 hours. By having Seneca shut down, that actually increases their emissions because they're less efficient and it's not operating at full capacity.
But it does mean that once you get industry there, the rules aren't the same. That industry as a whole is allowed to create more emissions than were there before. It's not like a zero policy. And I could say that in the Seneca standpoint, my airshed is worse off having had that put in as a result of it. So there is a negative impact from the industry.
But could you put into the vision plan that you envision not having those type of industry? I don't know if you could do it or not.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in the Wizard of Oz here. We can say a lot of things, but what are we going to get? And you know, I wanted to get back to that commercial statement because I think it ties in really well to what I think John was trying to say about the geography, and that is that when you look at the way that corridor is right now, it is commercial land. It is commercial land. What makes it offensive to me is that there are no design aesthetic standards and pollution and everything. So I have this vision that if we did have utilities out there and we had a series of design standards, that when I look at commercial and I could say light industry, it would mean that you would have the size, you're not going to have these giant buildings and you're not going to have a lot of need for lots of traffic, and it would just be more conducive to that, again, corridor, you know, and I think a downsized footprint maybe. And that's really what I was after. So commercial or light industry use, which minimizes the extent of the size of the footprint and
low impact or small scale or?
You know, I think of pollution. I think of you know, I think of the impact that having more traffic and having more emissions and having larger buildings will bring to that area, and it kind of offends a lot of the values I think people are trying to promote. But if it was smaller industry or commercial type building, it would be a smaller footprint, hopefully have less emissions.
Hey, Tom, you might want to actually do the research on what kind of industry has what kind of traffic. And
yeah,
you think that smaller buildings mean less traffic, but maybe they do really well. You know?
Well, and the industry intelligence specifically says that this area, you know, has rail access and I-5 access, so it's, you know, ideally suited for increased train traffic and increased truck traffic, and those things are not going to be great for those of us who live nearby.
Mm-hmm. I don't think rail is an issue. I mean, that's a main, the rail line through there is that's a freeway. I mean, you'll have to put arterials across the Highway 99. I would think that would be a barrier on anything on the CB Loop side of the tracks. I don't think Rails utilize that much.
I would say it's not utilized that much, but we're utilizing more.
Greater issue would be increased traffic on I-5.
And I think it would be an interesting thing to hear from your, I know there have been road studies and, you know, the 30th Avenue extension. I mean, it would be interesting to hear what the projection of what the traffic flow for the area would be. Which end is it going to come from? Is it going to be more from Goshen? Is it going to be more from, you know, the CB Loop, College View area? What changes would have to happen to the road to accommodate that? What is the real big picture look like?
I apologize. I have another meeting at 4 o'clock, and this was supposed to end at 3:30. So I'm going to have to. We're going to have to close and continue next week. But thank you very much for your discussion. And remember, David Halton last week was here to talk about that a little bit.
Did I miss that?
Well, what he said is that, you know, ODOT, they're going to decide what road is going to happen based on what land use is, and that's really, those are local decisions from local governments.
So there is not a plan like the 30th Avenue right now.
He also said there was no.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
They've been talking about the 30th Avenue extension since the 60s. Okay?
Oh yeah. I'm sure you remember quite a bit of hoopla about it.